Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Purpose Tune Podcast. The goal of my show is to create valuable content to broaden your knowledge, inspire you, and get you in the right mindset so that you can apply it in your own life to drive impact, generate meaning, and achieve your purpose.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Purpose Tune Podcast. My name is Kong Shang, and I am the host of the Purpose Tune Podcast. The goal of my show is to create valuable content to broaden your knowledge, inspire you to act, and get you in the right mindset so you can apply it in your own life to drive impact, generate meaning, and achieve your own purpose. Now, today's guest is Sarah Hinkfest. Sarah is a partner at Bain Capital Ventures, one of the world's leading investment firms, and works with growth stage founders across application software and fintech. Sarah spent the first half of her career in big data and predictive analytics SaaS, helping to scale applied predictive technologies, which was acquired by MasterCard in 2015. She is highly accomplished and has a bachelor's degree in economics and environmental science and public policy from Harvard and an MBA from Stanford University. She is originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Yay to the Midwesterns. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for having me on. I've been really looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. I think, you know, initially when we connected, having a chance to learn a bit more about your background, I was just fascinated by, your life transformation as a Midwestern to, like, you know, this West Coast. I don't even know what to explain to my audience, you know, the type of person you are, because you're just so dynamic in terms of your educational attainment, but also your accomplishment in the professional career. So let's start with life in the Midwest. How was that like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Both my parents are originally from Green Bay, and they are each from families of six. They actually went to kindergarten together. Like, it's very classic Midwest upbringing in that way. And then they were the rebels in their family who moved to Milwaukee, which is just 2 hours south, but they were the only ones in their family there. And both of them were raised in families of public service. And so I grew up in a family where I had members involved in politics, policemen, teachers, lawyers, and everyone was involved in the community. And so my parents made the explicit decision to raise us in the city of Milwaukee. And Milwaukee is one of the most, or by some accounts, one of the most segregated cities in the country. And so to be a white middle-class family raising children in Milwaukee was unusual to their friends, but was part of what they believed that they needed to do to really achieve their purpose in the world and make our community better. And I am so grateful that they made that decision because it really created the trajectory of my life as well in important ways. They sent us to Milwaukee Public Schools all the way throughout. I was actually looking this up last night in preparation. And so my high school, Rufus King, which is an amazing school, from the U.S. News and World Report rankings, it's 85% minority enrollment, 75% of students are economically disadvantaged, and it's the number one school in Milwaukee Public Schools. So it's a phenomenal school, but it's not the type of an educational backdrop that many students who ended up going on to Harvard, where I went for undergrad, had. And I was really grateful for that experience because what it did was this social education of really understanding how to connect with people from many different backgrounds and seeing really the development of my purpose as having the opportunities that I have and contributing that back to the communities where I came from and making sure that I'm enabling other people to show up as their full selves in their environment and experiences as well. So there are many elements of Wisconsin that I still keep with me that I haven't let go of, but I think the values that my family raise me with are really where it starts. One quick anecdote for you on this, actually, that I just thought of is in my living room still today, there are three portraits that my parents have hanging. One of them is Martin Luther King Jr. The second is JFK, and it's a poster of him sailing. I grew up sailing as well. Nice. And it's with his quote, "Don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And then the third, because we are in Wisconsin and my parents are from Green Bay, was the portrait of Brett Favre.
you got to have a portrait of Brett Favre. That's just a must for.
But it's a pretty good encapsulation, I would say, of the values that my parents raised us with.
That's amazing. That's beautiful. And, you know, I think going back to, you know, you sharing your experience about the diversity of your school. I came from the opposite in terms of where I grew up and went to school. It was 1% ethnic minority and 99% Caucasian. And there was truly a lack of diversity. And I've always felt like I was an outsider, treated like an outsider, and whatever, you know, my high school friends saw in television back in the day, they attributed to, you know, that to me and sort of assigned a perception of what Asian
labels
And so I remember I think it was my sophomore year of high school, I attended a conference in Madison, Wisconsin, at a high school there, and saw just the diversity of the school, and was just so inspired to you know, create something at my own school that would help people understand that, you know, although we're from different, you know, backgrounds, you know, different race, we still have these commonalities. And so
I love that.
So I worked closely with my high school counselor to create this program that would provide educational you know, just programs to folks to learn more about like what diversity means and why we should treat people of different backgrounds with respect and learn from each other. And that really made a lasting impact during my time there. And so,
amazing.
Yeah.
That actually reminds me, I had a chance to do something similar, actually. So I would say this concept of being a bridge builder, which you're talking about, which it sounds like you've also done for your entire life. And this podcast, I would say, is part of you doing that as well. It's another analogy that I identify in my life from, like, as a bridge builder. And I had a chance growing up to be involved in pretty stereotypically white communities as well, like you're describing. I did youth orchestra. I played soccer. Like, these were communities that were not, more suburban communities that weren't similar to my school. And so as you're describing, I actually created a program called Breaking Boundaries and did that across a couple of suburban schools and my school as well. And then also with the Girl Scouts, which was an organization that I had been involved with to bring students together across different schools in order to facilitate getting to know each other and realizing that so many of the stereotypes and labels, as you put it, are inaccurate. And it's really just that we're all people.
Right. Exactly. And you know, kudos to you for that effort, because, you know, at that time, I mean, still today, there's a lot of companies focusing on, you know, diverse equity inclusion efforts. And I'm just happy that we're now at a place where we can begin to engage in these types of conversations publicly, rather than just, you know, hiding it and shoving it under the rug, like back when
totally
high school. And so, So thanks for sharing about your background in the Midwest. So how did you, like, what made you transition to the West Coast? Like, what?
Went out east first.
That's right. So let's go there.
And I would say that the single decision that probably most changed the trajectory of my life was the decision to go to Harvard for undergrad. So I had always expected to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison, which, by the way, is, like, to say that I expected to do that is also an incredible thing, because it's a very phenomenal school and hard to get into. But I think because my parents both had connections to the school, like my mom went to undergrad, my dad went to law school there, I saw it as a kid. I ran around the campus and I imagined myself there for my whole life, and really wanted to be a Badger. And then I did, throughout middle school and high school, I did competitive speech and debate. And that, being able to compete on the national circuit, brought me to conferences or competitions, tournaments across the country. And one of them was at Harvard, the college. They sponsored this tournament. And it was my first time ever going there. And I thought it was the coolest place. I loved that it was, it was clear that there was this intellectual energy on the campus with everyone who was there. It also was deeply historically rooted. And so it's one of the oldest universities, if not the oldest in the country, 1636, I think. And so I loved that it had this history and it was deeply rooted in so much of the academic experience that's been in this country. And then the third thing that I loved was that it was based in the city. And so I was not excited about leaving the city and going to a university that was in suburbia. I wanted to stay like firmly rooted within this urban environment that I knew and loved. And so that was another really neat element that, you know, Harvard's on the T and everything. So I ended up applying and I was really lucky to get in. I did not get the most financial aid from Harvard. So then I orchestrated a negotiation basically where I got another school that gave me financial aid. I got that letter and then negotiated with Harvard to basically get the financial aid up. That was the only way it was possible for my family for me to go. But I was able to make that work. And I just remember getting on campus and I was like a kid in a candy store. The first week, like the pre-frosh week or whatever, when everyone's, all the freshmen are getting on campus, I missed our class photo because at the time of our class photo, there was the former head of Iran was there speaking at one of these big events, like it's called the forum, basically at campus. And I was so excited that this person that I'd read about through like on the news, right, that was actually here in front of me speaking and that I could ask questions of him. And so it was the first of many of many times that I was just driven to like a moth to the light, right? Just like driven to all, everything that I could learn when I was there. And it's a cornucopia of those experiences. And so being there was the first time that I felt truly intellectually challenged. I was surrounded by peers who had incredible academic experiences, professors who were the top of their fields and who challenged me and loved getting into rigorous debates around different areas that I was really excited about as well. And it was also another opportunity to be a bridge. So I came from a flyover state, right? Like that's, most people had never been to Wisconsin. And I was coming into this very different East Coast elite world. And so navigating that and finding my comfort and finding my people. And then I was also a bridge even in my academic work. So I was a joint major between economics and environmental policy and engineering. And that was an opportunity. So the economics crew was very pre-business oriented, pre-finance. And then the environmental engineering crew was very in the field, like tree huggers would be a negative stereotype, but definitely very different cultures. And so I was the one who was actually doing both fields. And in order to be a joint major, you had to complete the complete coursework for both of them. And then bringing it together in all my academic work, which was incredibly meaningful to me too. And so Harvard was an incredible experience for me and I absolutely loved it.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And I love just your story behind, you know, how that transition, you know, kind of changed, you know, your trajectory and how you perceived your career. How do you respond to people who say, well, don't be an elitist? Right, like to my mind, I'm like, this person has worked really, 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 really hard to get where they're at. And to be labeled an elitist is almost like a bad thing, which I mean, it's just mind blowing to me how people can think that way. What's your thought?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I agree. Because part of this decision, and I've had this a few times in my life, and I feel like when we have moments of opportunity, there's also this like, there's this conversation we play out around privilege, right? And so what does that mean? How do I take this opportunity, even if it comes with privilege? What responsibility does that create, et cetera? And so for me, going to Harvard, definitely it creates this set of subsequent opportunities that I was lucky enough to have because I was in that place. And so there is privilege that comes around with that. And elitism is where that idea comes from. And it's very, I think it's a very well-based idea. And so for me, if I just took those opportunities, the way I think about it is, if I just took those opportunities and did it only to further myself, that would be a failure of my values and a failure of my purpose. But the fact that I got the chance, like hard work and a ton of luck, right? Like all of these things are both. The fact that I have that chance and that opportunity, that I was in those circles of people, that I was able to apply to the certain jobs that I was, that I was able to like learn a new way of interacting with and being with the world, that I was now in the circles of power that I had only read about when I was a kid, right? Like now I was in those circles. To me, that has been that my life is around the systemic change, like the personal, the team, the systems, that the place of access that I have can enable me to create.
That's amazing. So as you reflect on your experience at Harvard and the access that you have now within your network, how do you plan to use your talent and gifts to make an impact in the world?
Yeah, what a small question. Yeah, so I mean, if we want to race kind of all the way ahead then to what I'm doing now in my career, it's through many different explorations, I am so thrilled with where I am now. And I'm grateful that I get to wake up every day and do what I do. And so, as you mentioned in the beginning, I'm a partner at Bain Capital Ventures, which is the venture arm of Bain Capital. And so my job is basically meeting with founders and entrepreneurs, management teams, and working with them in order to find the best individuals and teams for us to invest in, and developing and supporting those companies over their life cycle through their exit. And so that exit could be that they continue as a private company. It could be going public. It could be acquisition. Like there are many different outcomes of what that is. But the reason why I love it is manyfold. Part of it is that there is incredible power in our world that comes from allocators and sources of capital. Like we can agree or disagree that it should be that way, but the reality is that it is. And so what I saw over my life is that the individuals who have the money, who have the capital, are in the position of choosing which ideas actually proceed in the world. And so as a venture capitalist now, let me talk about the systems level change first, and then we'll kind of go down to the individual. So on a systems level, I get to work with the most talented, inspiring, agitating individuals, right? Like these are people who want to disrupt the world with their ideas. And that disruption could be the way that credit decisions are made when it comes to individual consumers and their financial lives. That could be the way that insurance is bought and sold for home insurance. And insurance as like a fundamental safety net has really important financial implications as well. One of the companies I'm working with now, what they're doing is it's a software to support individuals in disclosing their disabilities to their employer and finding ways for them to actually receive the accommodations they need to do their job. And so every one of these entrepreneurs that I have the incredible privilege to support is changing the world in their particular way. And with me as an allocator of capital, it's about fulfilling responsibilities to our LPs and creating good financial outcomes. And it's also making sure that the people who perhaps would not have the opportunity within venture capital, because they're not from these elite circles, or they don't look a certain way, or they don't have a certain background or whatever, that I can be that bridge builder and make sure that they also have a chance to pitch and have the opportunity to receive investment. So on a systemic level, I think it's the people that I'm working with, and it's the types of companies that I have the opportunity to support that are creating the world that we're going to live in tomorrow. And that is like, it's so cool that I get to be involved with that. On a team level, it is, how do I mentor and support individuals across the team so that they can bring their full selves to work? Mm-hmm. And I like, it's well established at this point and well researched that not only is there so few venture dollars that go to individuals of color and women and other diverse groups, it's very small, but it's also reflected in the people who are investors as well. Mm-hmm. So it's very, it's not at all representative to have female investors or individuals of color. Mm-hmm. And so part of that, I think, like as you talked about diversity, inclusion, and belonging, right? Like it's three different components. And how can I, as a leader of a team, help to make the entire team and culture more conducive to diversity? Because I think that makes us just a much better firm as well through all these dynamics. And then there's also the personal level. So that's like three different systems of change. And one example on the personal side is I had my baby last year. So he's 16 months old now. Thank you. But it's like on a very, like venture capital is 24/7, literally. Like I'm never done with my job. I'm always learning about something new. I'm always meeting someone new. I'm always going to something. Like it is literally all consuming, all encompassing. Mm-hmm. And so is parenting. like both of those jobs are like all consuming. And so it's one of the many reasons why I would say it's been harder for women to break into this level of venture capital. And for harder for women to become successful founders as well. And so being someone who is wearing that, who's like not afraid to talk about it, who often will like share pictures of my child and like sometimes they'll be in calls or whatever. And I think through my own choices, I can normalize part of what I want to see, because again, I think it creates better outcomes for the entire industry.
Right. And it also sets, you know, a really good example to your clients and prospective clients that, look, you can be a mom and do both. And I think that's wonderful. Like you're setting yourself as a role model and example to your community, which is great.
It's really hard. it's really hard. Yeah. And not being, I think there can be, and I'm definitely guilty of it as well, but there can be a pull like for the duck syndrome of above the water, the duck looks fine, but under the water, the duck is like swimming. So there can be like a desire to make it seem easy from the outside, but also I'm comfortable talking about the ways that it's hard. And I think that also encourages other people to feel comfortable sharing with me as well. And none of these things are done alone. And so creating that community of empathy is part of what I think will actually break through some of these systemic barriers that have existed.
Right, yeah. And the work you're doing is so important, and I'm with you all the way. Coming from a family that didn't have much growing up, like my parents were political refugees of the Vietnam War. They had to leave their country and resettle here in the US, spoke no word of English, had to basically leave everything behind and into this brand new world. So it's, I understand how important that, you know, your work is to ensure that, you know, people of color and women are being represented at the highest level. And throughout my career, I've always have a passion and focus on, you know, driving organizations to be more inclusive, ensuring that, you know, people are represented, because I myself, you know, was not. I experienced the pain and the frustration and lack to access that me and my peers did. And I think the world is changing in how they view women and people of color, that, you know, we're just as talented as anyone else. And
totally could not agree more. Yeah.
And these hardships are actually, you know, these richness that are added to our lives. It pushes us to be better, to have the courage to fight through these hardships.
Exactly.
And succeed. And there's all these types of conversations in technology, especially when it comes to DEI. And I know when I was in Silicon Valley, there's, you know, this challenge of, you know, access being provided to tech bros and not to like people of color and women.
Yeah.
And the conversation has continued to evolve over time. But the consistent theme is that we're all humans, and we all have a brain, and we're just as talented as anyone else, and we can succeed.
Yeah.
And it's that unconscious bias that people have that prevents, you know, providing capital to the underrepresented populations. And so, you know, I've got the chance to work with some of the world's top leadership development companies in the world, coaching executives on unconscious bias, and, you know, ensuring that their recruiting process is inclusive and creating a work environment where people can feel psychologically safe to show up and be who they are authentically and belong in a company. And so I'm happy that
it's amazing work.
it's amazing work. It's beautiful work, and I love it. And I find joy in it. However, it's not always easy, because you're having difficult conversations about things that people don't really talk about, don't want to talk about, because it ignites courage out of them. And it takes a lot of capacity and energy. But when you're able to coach business leaders through these types of conversations, at the end of the tunnel is light. It's beautiful. People get to connect with one another. And just think about the power of vulnerability, you know, Brené Brown's work, you know, having courage, you know, what does effective leadership look like? Like, all that requires courage, vulnerability.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Being able to, you know, be in a position to coach business leaders that have the power to effect change is pretty phenomenal work, I think.
Totally. The phrase that comes to mind hearing you talk about that in your work is that opportunity is distributed, access is not.
Right.
And so there are people everywhere who are incredibly capable and the best entrepreneurs, but so few of them are actually discovered, because it's only in circles of power where that access exists. And so that's actually a disservice to, like, from where I sit, it's a disservice to our limited partners that we are creating returns for if we're not finding the best entrepreneurs. And that requires breaking through some of these barriers.
Right, exactly. Because when you have a lens that's broad and inclusive, it encompasses, you know, all these diversity of thoughts, contributing to, you know, how you go about providing opportunities and access, it really does make a difference in terms of how you get to make an impact in the community, in the world. And yeah. It's not just a disservice to, you know, or company or community, but to the entire world, because, you know,
totally.
It's just,
yeah. I mean, the companies I support are literally changing our lives.
Like, right. Exactly.
It's amazing. It's entrepreneurship that does that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I've been in conversations with startup founders and CEOs that have shared with me personally that they're frustrated with their career path, and you know, they don't see people who look like them, especially people of color and women. And mm-hmm. that's why they decided to launch their own company. For example, there's one company out here. They were just recently funded by Google.
Awesome.
And you know, she's a woman of color. She's a woman. I mean, it's woman, and it's like two identities: a person of yeah. color and also a woman. And yeah. and so she found it difficult to climb the corporate ladder. Felt like her voice wasn't heard, and she wasn't being represented. And so she decided to leave her corporate job and pursue her entrepreneurial aspirations. And now she's building a great company that's, you know, all inclusive, where 60% of the people that work for her are people of color, and, you know, about 50% are women. And yeah. she gets to make an impact and show up every day doing what she loves. And that, I think, is fulfilling work, which ties to purpose.
Totally.
On to the next question. What does purpose mean to you, and how does it show up in your life?
Purpose for me is what I'm meant to do. So it's the, it is the reason that I am in this life, is the way that I think about purpose. And I think everyone has a purpose. Mm-hmm. When I say it like that, it sounds like it's very deterministic. I think that's true, and it's always unfolding. And so as I reflect on what my purpose is, it is informed by my background, my upbringing, my values, the path that I've been on. But I also can't tell you what the full exploration of that purpose will be, or what the full instantiation of it will be when I look back in 50 years at what my life has been, mm-hmm. because I don't even know the full extent of what opportunities I will have and what impact I can make going forward. Mm-hmm. And so I think about it much more in the micro, in the here and now. Like, what are the ways that in what I am doing, that I can show up in the best way to make the world around me a better place, and like leave it better than when I came. Mm-hmm. And so it's the small ways that together create the arc of what I consider my purpose. That's the way I think about it, at least.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You mentioned in their impact, and mm-hmm. I want to dive a little deeper into that notion of impact, because that is a consistent theme that the guest on my show mentioned. What does that mean to you when you say impact?
Impact is a change in the world, is the way yeah. that I think about it. And it could be something not happening, right? And so, for example, in relationships of mentorship that I have with individuals at work or individuals at other teams, the opportunity for someone to stay in the game and to not leave because they feel heard and seen and valued, like that's impact, because there's still something bad didn't happen, which would be them leaving, like as a talented person, because they didn't feel seen, heard, or valued. It could also be something happening that wouldn't have happened either. That could also be impact. And so an example of that would be pounding the table to make an investment, or doing the work in order to provide the analytical framework and argument to make an investment, mm-hmm. when absent my participation around the table, that may not have happened. And so then the impact is what that company does do going forward as a result of that additional investment, and then the support that we provide as well. So I think about it as like what's changed in the world, I guess.
Right. Yeah, it's always finding opportunities to make a change in the world for the better is what I'm hearing from you.
And, yeah. For the better is important.
Yeah, right. Just to make a change. I don't know if it's good or bad, but just
make I mean, impact could be bad, though. If you can't have bad impact, which obviously is not what I'm getting for. It's also the little ways, like in family. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it goes back to intention, right? And your intention is for the better.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah.
And sorry, you were saying earlier about family.
I was going to say there's also little impacts that the point I'm making is other people don't have to know for it to matter, right? And so in some ways it's the stuff that I do that no one else sees that are the most impactful, you know. And one example of that is the way that my husband and I are true partners in supporting our son. You know, these are things that other people don't see and are everything to our son's life and like how he develops. Right. And so that's something I'm really proud of. That's not at all professional.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes I can't remember who said it, but there's a quote out there that says something along the lines of, you know, your impact or purpose in the world doesn't have to be big, but it could be small and it could start within your circles. You know, friends or family, and you know that sometimes that's good enough, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be, you know, this grand thing or public thing. And so I completely agree. I want to, you know, pull back a little bit and talk about identities. I know that you've mentioned, you know, parts of your identities, and I've been recently fascinated by how we sort of tie our identities into our success. And so, for example, what I mean is, you know, I could say I'm a person of color and I have been denied access to capital for, I don't know, an example, creating a business. And I'm using my identity as a person of color as an excuse of why I'm not getting capital. And I guess I want your thoughts on that, because people, like in the personal development space, you know, there's these gurus that say, you know, you could change your life, change your identity, how you see the world, and you can be successful. Right. I mean, of course, the process is
interesting. Yeah. It's such a fascinating topic. So I agree with you too. The way that I thought about it is, there are many times when I felt that something has or hasn't happened. Like the narrative that I tell myself, the story I tell myself is that what happened in the world was a consequence of a part of my identity, exactly as you're saying. Mm-hmm. That, however, that doesn't change the world. Like that doesn't change anything in the world. And so it's at that moment, you're at the threshold of saying my identity has come up in this situation. Mm-hmm. Then so what? Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I try to choose to say, then I'm going to prove it.
Right.
And so other people may think that because I'm a woman or because I'm from the Midwest or like whatever it is, like another one for me is I never did investment banking. And so being a growth investor without investment banking is very unusual. Mm-hmm. Instead, I spent the first 6 years of my career actually in a company, growing, scaling, developing, creating a company. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing set of experiences, but it's not the standard path that many people have gone on. And so there are times when I feel like, oh, well, because I don't have this background, I won't have, like, I'm not given this opportunity. But I took that and I decided to say, well, let me prove that one does not need that in order to do the job just as well, if not better. Mm-hmm. And so let me show the power of how my differences actually create more opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's not possible always to do that. And so there's no judgment at all in it. I'm just sharing the way that I try, when I am level-headed, the way that I try to think about it, which is I'll either be pushed down by you or I'm going to stand up and fight. And I'm going to prove that this is the wrong way of seeing this situation. Mm-hmm. And I try to put myself in that latter position, mm-hmm. because I think sometimes the only way to break boundaries is literally going through them. Breaking barriers sometimes is about changing the system. Other times it's about literally walking through the door.
Right. That's amazing. I love that. And that's such a great mindset to have, because you're choosing a mindset of possibilities and opportunities and, creativity. You're saying, look, these are my identities, whether you like it or not, they are part of who I am, and I'm going to show.
And I can't change them.
Right, exactly. There's the most important thing is I can't change myself. And so I'm going to show up as I am, whether you like it or not, because this is who I am. And I'm going to use my talents and gifts to make sure that the things that I do in terms of providing access and opportunities to companies, or how I go about engaging with my prospective clients or with friends and family is respectful, is inclusive, and it creates this environment where people can just be who they are. And mm-hmm. I love that. And I'm very much the same way too. I could, be a victim of my, of the things that didn't go my way, or I could be step up, have the courage to show up authentically and say, look, these are bad identities. And I certainly have had hardships in my life based on these identities, and they've made me stronger, wiser, more powerful.
Exactly.
And courageous because I overcame them. And so it's the story we tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. And how we choose to live it that really maximize our life or minimize and diminishes. And so I think that's great that, that's a wonderful perception that a lot of people listening to the show can take away. I know we're just about time, so I just have a few more questions. What advice would you give to the listeners of the show when it comes to either showing up authentically, fully, and achieving success?
Building on what we just said, actually, I would say one thing that I've always been aware of is building my coalition. And so, especially in a podcast, it's possible to say I a lot. You're asking me for my opinion on things, so I said I a lot. Mm-hmm. But very few things are done without a we, if anything. And so really recognizing the people in my life from whom I can draw inspiration, the people who I can count on, the people I can go to and be totally honest and vulnerable, and have that moment of victimhood before I get up and I'm ready to change something. Mm-hmm. And that's a reciprocal relationship, right? These are strong friendships, my husband, my family, coworkers, right? My advice is to not imagine you can do it alone. Right. And really be intentional about building those people and being grateful and saying thank you and remembering the little things that matter to them in their lives and showing up when they need you, because that's how you'll have them for you to show up as well. Mm.
That's beautiful, because what you're saying is going back to the grateful part, I start every morning with three things I'm grateful for, and that has tremendously impacted my life. I never really thought that practicing gratitude really could change one's perception about life, because we're so wired to think about things in a negative light. For example, you turn on the news and everything's just so negative, right? I stopped watching the news as much as I used to.
Yeah. Or even our stories of ourselves. Like, we always want more, or, you know, we're trying to push for things. Yeah.
Exactly. We're always trying to push for things that we don't want in our way, or things to go the way that we want. We get disappointed and frustration, which leads to depression, anxiety, and stress. So, like, instead of like push, what I do is I sit back and just like meditate and like find three things at least to be grateful for every morning. And that has really helped me. The other thing you mentioned was, you know, give back. And that's kind of, is, you know, that ties to our notion earlier about impact. When we give back, either to, you know, our direct family members or the community that we're part of, or society as a whole, there's value in that. We not only are perceived to be valuable by other people, but also we feel good about ourselves. And, you know, of course, we could dive into like all these scientific, you know, facts about why giving back is actually really good for your, you know, your self-worth and confidence and all that stuff. But quite simply, I think one of the easiest ways that people can really tap into a sense of fulfillment is by giving back to the community part of.
Yeah. And this is so corny, but that is exactly what I believe my job is. Like, my job is in service to our LPs and in service to our founders. And so it's truly a job of service.
Right. And that's the kind of leadership that we all want, is servant leadership. So this has been a very fascinating conversation. I love having you here. For folks that want to connect with you, can you tell us, where can they find you?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm on LinkedIn, just my name, Sarah Hinkfist, and then Twitter is at Sarah Hinkfist as well.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, folks, if you enjoyed this show, this episode, please reach out to Sarah. I know she's done some amazing work in the community, and it's a chance for you to connect with her and find out how, you know, there could be, you know, a meaningful collaboration partnership in the future. So, Sarah, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed this conversation very much. I wish we could continue. Maybe in the near future, have you on again and talk more about your work with Bain.
Awesome. Thanks, Kwan. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.